This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents World Keeper, The Dawn of an Era, by Justin Miller, narrated by Stephen Bell Davies. Chapter 1. I let out a sad sigh when I watched the scene of Shara being reunited with her family. Although it was a happy ending for her, to be able to see them all once again, a lot of people did not share her luck. In fact, Shara herself had been truly fortunate. From what I could tell, Aravi sent a message to her father, letting her know when and where to find her. After speaking a bit with Irina, I had learned that most families did not get reunited for weeks, or even months after any given member died. There were just too many souls to process, so it was no wonder. Only on rare occasions when the dead had family members present when they crossed over did they get the chance to reunite quickly. Of course, that also got me thinking, and I asked the death goddess that I had summoned to my room, "How did they do the transfer to the afterlife? I thought only you could create those portals." Irina smiled slightly, bent over at the waist as she watched the screen. Unlike myself, she only seemed to be happy that the halfling family was quickly reunited. It's a technique that we worked on for decades, and one of the things that were absolutely necessary in order to prepare for my ascension, she explained. It needs to use a total of 20,000 spirit energy to activate, more if you wanted to make a bigger transfer. Even with all of those people, they will need to rest for a couple days before they can do that again. However, when it activates, it allows the transfer of souls within the area from the living world to the underworld. The technique can also be used in reverse, but doing so that way is far easier, as they can draw upon the energy of the underworld itself. Hearing her explanation, I nodded my head slightly. "So you are still unable to form a stable portal, and can just open up gaps to brute force it? Kind of like what the Chimera soul did when it forced its way into the living world." Irina grimaced slightly at the comparison, but nodded nonetheless. "Exactly. However, that creature did not know how to wield the energy of the underworld, so it had relied on its own energy to forcefully break the barrier between the worlds. Unfortunately, I am still the only one able to create an actual portal, though they are researching how to solve that problem." That did make sense. I'm sure eventually they would be able to create devices that would allow them to quickly travel from the afterlife to the living world whenever they wanted. But for now, such things were only distant dreams. "I see. Thanks for clearing all of that up for me," I said with a smile. With that, Irina stood up and stretched slightly before turning to leave the room. "I've got to go make sure everything is ready. This war is probably going to have effects in the underworld as well, and I need to let the governor prepare." After saying that, she left the room and simply vanished in the hall. "You're just going to disappear dramatically like that. Why bother walking out the door?" I couldn't help but ask myself that question as I turned back to look at the monitor again, fast-forwarding once more. After the Battle of Savor, those halflings who had originally chosen to leave before the fight eventually made it to the rest. Along the way, many began to feel ashamed of themselves for abandoning their kin to die in a hopeless battle. Yet at the same time, they were completely aware of the fact that their presence would not have changed the outcome of the battle. And even if they did, there would only be another one just beyond the horizon. As such, they did the only thing they could. They passed along Shara's message, her dying will. They told anyone who would listen at the rest about the army that had invaded the forest. They spoke of how Shara and her bloodied hand stood there to defend every halfling in the forest, even when they were outnumbered beyond belief. And they spoke of how she died. Some sought to embellish the story, putting in details as if they themselves were there. In some stories, Shara stood atop a pile of corpses, fending off attacks from every angle. In others, she was dashing from foe to foe, leaving death and destruction in her wake. Yet every story had something in common. Shara led the people of Savor to fight a hopeless battle, all for the sake of her kin, those who they had sworn to protect. She did not die in shame. and not one of those who had left save her tried to mock her for what she did. They had seen the army. That is the reason that they chose to flee in the first place. To any that heard the story, Shara was a hero, probably the first true hero among the halflings, regardless of those who had earned the class named such. Shara was an example. She showed that it was possible for them to fight, to defend against such odds for her people. And after sending scouts to save her only to find it was a wasteland of death, they knew that she had succeeded. The enemies that she fought against did not quickly return to the forest, and the sheer number of bodies being feasted upon by the scavenger beasts told them that the stories were not in the least exaggerated. If anything, those scouts that had investigated Saver felt that the stories were lacking. What they found was a sea of flesh and blood, mangled bodies scattered as far as they could see. By that time, Shara's body had long since been dragged away by some nameless beast, and they could not even gather enough of the remains to identify people. So there was no way for them to receive a proper burial, to be put at rest beneath the ground, as was tradition. Instead, they brought dozens of halflings to the ruins of Saver, all armed with bone daggers. These halflings got to work, each one picking a tree and carving a name, before moving on to another. The bloodied hand had died to protect those who live in the forest, so they decided for the trees to mark their graves. In this manner, over 100 trees were marked, each one carved with a name and a symbol of a palm print. Yet no matter how they tried, not all of the members of the bloodied hand had people who remembered their names. Many were known only to the other members. For those, they did something special. They gathered in front of the largest tree, which Saver itself had been built around, and carved one last memorial. In these woods, Shara stood with her brothers and sisters who joined her cause. She fought for what she believed to be right, to defend all of us. With this, we let you return to Mother's embrace. May she be more fair to you than we were. But no, we will never forget. For Shara and the bloodied hand. This message was carved deep into the tree, causing many daggers to break as they wanted to ensure that this memorial would last until the tree itself was no more. This was the best that they could do for her, to show her wherever she was that they had not forsaken her. Rather, her actions were causing a change that she had never expected, one that no mortal being could have. After leaving the memorial, the halflings of the forest gathered to retrieve the dead. Yet the ones being retrieved were not the halflings, but their enemies. As they had the skin of beasts, they were treated as such. Their lower bodies were skinned and used for leather, while the few halfling bodies they found were buried. Once they had gathered as much leather as they could from those creatures, they used them to send messages. One message to every rest within reach, and a request to spread the word. The message was simple, a tale worthy of being known to all. It was the story of a little girl who did the unthinkable, the story of how she grew up with her father, journeyed with him to repay a blood debt, and lost him in that same journey, a story of how she saw the cruelty hidden within these intelligent beasts, and formed a group of her own to fight. Yet she did not lead them to slaughter as her enemy would have. Instead, she used her group to defend against the fiercest of odds, to fight back an unimaginable army, and she won, dying for those she loved. These messages were extremely significant, for two entirely different reasons. First of all, though this fact was largely unknown to the halflings, this would become the first full book in history. Although there existed scrolls of leather, those were but a single page. Only the elves and beastkin had begun to learn how to create papyrus, so a full book of this size was unheard of. Secondly, and this was far more significant to the halflings in the immediate future, this was a call to arms. With this book, everyone would know exactly what happened. The word would spread, and people would come south, because this was not just the story of one heroic girl. It was a warning. To the south, there exist creatures that would act to hunt down every man, woman, and child. Faced with this warning, the halflings only had two options. One, they could flee to the north, move as far away from the threat as they could. Doing so would guarantee that they would live the rest of their lives in peace, but would perhaps condemn their children to suffer this fate in their place. Or the other option, to follow Shara's way. And many chose this, heading south towards the forest. Although this meant that they themselves would have to spill blood, it meant that their children would be able to be free. Their future generations would not have to suffer under the threat of these beasts. It was months before the first centaur reported back to King's Hope, not because the journey was long, or that they lost their way, but because they had been utterly terrified by what had happened. Of those who managed to escape, not a single one had dared to walk any path that took him through tall grass. Some had even avoided the watering holes, afraid that there might be lurking hidden dangers beneath the surface. So when the first man came back, it was clear to see that he had not had food or drink for days. He was on the verge of collapse, and almost jumped right out of his skin when one of the guards called out to him. It wasn't until he had been nursed for several days when they learned that he was part of the army that had left the plains. Although anyone could tell by looking at him that he had experienced a living nightmare, there were still those who secretly mocked him for running from the battle. Some asked about the condition of the Knights of the Round who had led the charge, and then refused to believe that they had fallen within the first moments of battle. Many of them ended up believing that he had simply ran away as soon as the fight began, his fear taking control of him. Yet there were those who did not question this in the least. The remaining Knights of the Round had soon heard this report, and it was as if their fears had come true. Before the army had left, each of the knights had been given a promise scroll, which would only be complete upon the death of the carrier. This was a token measure to see whether or not the one holding the scroll lived. When the Knights of the Round died, the original scroll that was kept in King's Hope shattered into light, showing one of two results. Either the scrolls that had been taken with them were torn in the battle, or the three Knights of the Round had died. Naturally, those remaining wished to believe the former. After all, the Knight of Leadership had been chosen to be the next king. It was only when the story was again verified by more people coming into the city that the knights went to deliver the news to the king. Chapter 2. After some time, I pried my head away from the screen, shaking it side to side. Although I had largely fast-forwarded through the aftermath of that war, I was still fully aware of what had happened. After all, I had been keeping a close watch, and slowed things down when something interesting looked like it was about to happen. At least now it will be a while before anything else takes place, I thought to myself with a light sigh. For the halflings, it would take time for their people to get the message and make the journey south. As for the centaurs, I doubted that they would be able to gather another army of that size for several years. After all, that was almost 5,000 casualties, not only from King's Hope, but even counting the entire centaur population, that was a big dent. On the other hand, the halflings lost only a few hundred. Granted, they had the advantage in terms of preparation and location, but it would still be a huge blow to the centaurs. As such, I once again began fast-forwarding through the world's time. This time I was not moving only a week or a month at a time, but rather in leaps of 5 years. With the initial confrontation out of the way, it felt like they had at least that long before anything major happened again. Sure enough, after the first skip, only a few things had changed. For the halflings, they had 3 extra towns to set up along the northern border of the woods, and the population for that area had grown explosively. Looking at the map, I could still see more and more groups heading south to join that area. As for the centaurs, they had apparently set up their 3rd city. This one was located directly outside of the forest, where they had first fought with the halflings. Going by the map, the city had been named Sorrow's Shield, a rather unique name for a city, but its structure appeared to be identical to that of King's Hope. Everything from the circular wall to the interior buildings had been replicated. While I was looking at that, "Dale! Dale! Dale! Dale!" a very energetic voice broke me out of my concentration. Looking up, I saw a certain elf goddess panting for breath, her chest rising and falling as she bent over with her hands on her knees. It looked as if she had just run a marathon, but... "You're doing that on purpose," I shouted at her, shaking my head to remove the purposely seductive image she painted with her body. "Am not," she retorted. "Okay, maybe a bit. But still, we figured out something important. You've got to come take a look." Rian reached down, tugging on my arm to pull me to my feet. When I did get up, I did not immediately follow her out of the room. Given her excitement, it was obvious that she had discovered something related to magic. As for the we, she mentioned, that had to be her and Tubrak. The two of them should have still been looking into making the god items. "Slow breaths and speak." Seeing that I did not intend to follow her without a reason, Rian puffed her cheeks out in a pout. "Moo. Fine." She took a deep, exaggerated breath. "Tubrak and I discovered a new crafting technique that could change everything." Listening to that, I nodded my head slightly. "Okay, let's go then." No sooner had the words passed my lips than our surroundings had changed. Before I could even think, I realized that we had moved to Tubrak's forge.
"Oh, you managed to get him down here after all? Good on you, lass,"
the dwarf said, a massive steel hammer draped over his shoulder, held by one hand on its lower shaft.
"How much did you have to tell him?"
Rian kicked the ground in a sulk, lowering her head. "About half of it," she admitted, causing Tubrak to laugh, his gut shaking.
"Ha ha ha! Looks like I won the bet, don't it?"
he asked, with a strange smirk, Rian nodding, slightly in agreement. "Okay, okay, slow down. First, what is this bet? Second, why am I down here?" I asked, looking between the two of them.
"Ah, right."
Tubrak cleared his throat, lifting his hammer up over his head so that he could set it down on the ground beside himself.
"The lass and I had a tiny bet, you see. If she managed to get you down here without explaining nothing, her godly weapon would be a trident. She had this elaborate diagram with each prong representing a different side of the scale, and I wasn't having none of it." He shook his head strongly. "You have any idea how hard it is to carve those patterns in this stuff?" "Well, no, I guess you wouldn't. Yet, still, since she lost, she's getting a staff. It'll have to be a fancy one for sure, but a staff nonetheless," he concluded, nodding his head. "Anyways, for what we brought you here for, take a look at these."
Tubrak waved his hand, causing two identical tables to form above the ground, flanking me with them on either side. Each one had identical objects on it, a single long rectangle of metal, and a sword. Just going by their appearances, they seemed to be using the same materials, so I wasn't sure what was supposed to be special about them. Maybe they have enchantments? Thinking that, I picked up the first sword, the one on my left. Focusing on it, I activated my ability to appraise the weapon.
"Keeper cheats, go!"
"Iron longsword. Sharpness, 9. Weight, 0.9 kilograms. Durability, 100 for 100. And it was a regular sword. Maybe a bit better than what I myself could make, but not enough to really get excited about. Focusing on the ingot, I found that it was also extremely normal. Shaking my head, I set it down and turned to the table that was now behind me. However, this time, as soon as I picked up the sword, I felt something strange, which was immediately confirmed by my appraisal. Spell Iron Longsword. Sharpness, 36. Weight, 1.2 kilograms. Durability, 400 for 400. The difference in the stats between the two was enormous. Although the appearance of the window seemed a bit off, I couldn't help but look at the two of them and ask dubiously, "Is this one enchanted?" I could clearly feel the presence of mana in the sword, so I couldn't help but ask. Yet the window looked distinctly different than the results gained from a normal enchantment. "Not at all," Rian shouts out, waving her arms and shaking her head back and forth.
That's the beauty of it. Spell oars. She seemed so excited, unable to speak properly, so she looked to Tubrock for assistance, who simply sighed.
The lass is right. Here.
He caused a second sword to appear on the table that had the spell iron longsword. Once I picked it up, I confirmed that what he said had been the truth, after all. Enchanted spell iron longsword. Sharpness 32, plus 320. Weight 1.1 kilogram. Durability 400 for 400. Plus 4,000 for 4,000. This sword seemed to defy all logic, given what I understood about weapon statistics.
That's an enchanted spell iron sword, Tubrock said, though I had seen the results myself. It's also the strongest possible sword that you can make using only iron. However, with that, you won't have to worry about resistance unless you were cutting through iron bark or similar materials.
Very gently, I put the weapon back down on the table.
Okay.
Explain, I said in a quiet voice, thoroughly impressed. How did you two create a sword 10 times better than what I thought was the most you could enchant a weapon like that? Tubrock was just about to continue the explanation when Rian cut in.
We enchanted the materials, she said excitedly, practically bouncing in her spot. It's one of the things we were researching, whether enchanted materials would have an impact on the final product. When we only enchanted an ingot, all we got was a lump of metal that was harder to shape into a weapon, and it turned into a normal enchanted sword when it was done. But when we enchanted the ore itself, before putting it through any refinement process, something happened. The mana and the natural energy within the raw ore seemed to combine and cause a strange mutation in the ore. Most of the results ended up shattering immediately, but eventually we found the right combination. She took a brief moment to pause, taking a deep breath before continuing. When the proper amount of mana was applied to the enchantment, the ore mutated into what we are calling a spell ore. In this case, spell iron. Spell ores have two distinct properties. The first is that they are ridiculously hard to forge due to the durability increase of an enchanted item. In fact, from start to finish, they hold the attributes of a fully enchanted equivalent of its non-spell variety. The second and more important property is what you just saw. An item made from spell ore can be enchanted a second time due to the mutation in the base ore. A spell ore item isn't considered enchanted, and in fact can hold mana far better than a normal item of its type.
Okay, now I could see how this could be exploited. And in fact, it scared me a little bit to consider whether or not the dwarves in the world below were approaching this level of craftsmanship. Just imagining an army fitted with weapons like this would let them strike down almost anyone that got in their way.
Tubrock, I said, looking to the dwarf.
He nodded his head slightly to acknowledge me before I asked, "What is the level of difficulty in making that?" I pointed directly to the overpowered sword that he had shown me.
"For me? I can do it as long as I'm up here. For a mortal?"
Tubrock lowered his head, chubby fingers stroking through his beard.
"I'd say 10 expert blacksmiths and 30 enchanters might be able to pull off one sword if they all work together and know what they are doing."
He shrugged his shoulders at the vague guess.
"If not for me being able to create any kind of forging tool I can think of, and having unlimited energy to work with, I might not have been able to create it.
You'd have to ask the cat, lass, for a time frame on when mortals would be able to manufacture these. She'd know more about that than us." His words did reassure me a little. While the dwarves were the only race in the world right now that possessed blacksmiths, they were quite lacking in terms of enchanters. That class was dominated primarily by the elves, and a few of the unicorn centaur variants. At least the scene of ungodly equipment appearing in the world was still a long ways away. Thinking that, I let out a sigh of relief before turning to address the two of them again.
"Is there anything else to report while you have me here?"
Tubrock gave that another moment of thought before he answered.
"I'm about to get started on the various god weapons in a bit. Now that we know about spell ores, we can create some powerful artifacts without having to wait for better enchantments."
After that, Rian shook her head. "Nothing new from me, aside from this," she said, dejectedly.
Nodding my head at that, I smiled slightly.
Good. Okay, I'll be heading back now before something inevitably happens with that war while I'm away.
As for this, I reached down to grab the sword of ungodly sharpness.
I'm a-taking this. Personal sword? Get?
The last thing I saw before I shifted myself back to my room was Tubrock giving a knowing smile, laughing aloud as Rian continued sulking. Setting the sword down with the hilt propped up against the desk, I quickly checked on the status of the world. To my great surprise, nothing at all had happened while I was away. No interspecies fights had sprung up, and neither side had even moved any closer to the other. Imagined crisis averted.
Hey, the one time you don't think something like that will happen is when it catches you by surprise. Safer to always expect it. Anyways, time for another skip.
Chapter 3. The next several years of the war between the halflings and the centaurs was largely uninteresting. It wasn't until almost a full 20 years after the first conflict when the two sides met again. Though, like the first time with Saver, this was not a full-scale attack, but rather a large group splitting up from the main force to explore. By now, roughly a third of the halfling population had managed to travel to the centaur continent. This already gave them numbers similar to the centaur population, though this time it was the centaurs that had the home field advantage. Anyways, I decided to speed things up a bit, curious what the actions of the halfling group would cause. Watching with time moving forward at a little over 1,000 times normal speed, things actually looked like a real-time strategy game. I could see them doing their best to avoid any and all confrontations, taking paths that would guarantee that they would not run into any herds. Though, while I was glad that they weren't getting into any fights, I was a bit surprised by what I found out when I focused on them. To be specific, their mission was not to attack the centaurs at all. While they were members of the halfling's army, which apparently had been named the Bloodied Hand, none of them were particularly strong fighters. Whether it was their hunter class or their monster tamer class, none of them had gone above 20. However, when it came to their scout class, things were entirely different. Each one of them had a minimum of 50 levels as a scout. That, coupled with the thoughts and conversations I could pick up by focusing on the group, and it was pretty obvious what their goal was. They were mapping out the centaur's terrain. I had to admit that I was a bit impressed that they were able to come up with that strategy. But it was not too surprising, given that most halflings never stop traveling. The ability to know the land around you is practically a required skill to have if you want to survive that life, though I was not sure to what extent they planned on scouting. After spending roughly an hour watching them, nearly 2 months had passed within the world, and yet by that time they had showed no signs of turning back. They had not even made it all the way to Trival's Hold yet, let alone King's Hope. Does this group of 300 halflings seriously plan to map out the entire plains before they go back to the forest? I couldn't help but question. Thinking to that, I couldn't help but remember that Terra and Aravi both made incarnations in the halfling race. Pulling out my handy communication paper, I wrote a message to each of them, asking to meet in my room. No sooner had I put down the pencil I manifested to write said message than my door burst open and a tiny ball of cuteness jumped up onto my lap.
"What do you need, bro?"
Aravi asked in an excited voice, leaning over and hugging me with her small arms.
"Well, someone has been a bit bored," I said with a smirk, causing the halfling to pout slightly.
"Everyone's just been so busy lately," she complained,
crossing her arms in front of herself.
"Big Sis has been so tired lately because of managing 2 mortals, and the other sisters have all been busy either training or getting used to being here," she said with a huff.
"That's actually part of why I asked you here. You created an incarnation when everyone else did, right?"
When she nodded her head, I smiled, continuing. "What's yours up to down there?" I needed to find out whether she was actually involved in the war right now or not, before anything else. though simply being the halfling goddess would let her help me figure out what their plans were faster than looking for the key figures myself. Hearing that, Auravi's pout only became heavier. My family was too far north when the message went out. It took a whole 5 years to even reach them, and when it did, they decided to avoid the conflict altogether and kept heading north. She shook her head dejectedly, looking down at the floor. Even if I had left by the time I finished growing up, I'd probably not make it there until the war was over, unless I used my god powers to cheat. But even then, I don't have a build that would be useful for the war, for either side. It was at around this time that Terra slowly made her way into the room. Judging by how she was still dragging her feet when she walked, she was obviously as lethargic as she had been before.
"Hey, Dale, you called?"
she asked, yawning loudly as she leaned against the doorway, smiling slightly when she saw Auravi sitting in my lap.
"Hey, Rivi."
"Hey, sis,"
Auravi replied with a warm smile. "Bro was just asking about our mortals." Terra gave a slow nod, not waiting for me to ask her directly before speaking.
"Probably the halfling one. Mine is in the rest at the forest, though I'm doing my best not to get involved with the fighting."
Terra brought her hand up to her mouth to muffle another yawn, before continuing. "With these numbers, I can tell that the halflings have an overwhelming advantage now, so I'm just waiting for the right time to advocate peace. You know, when my opinion isn't outnumbered 50,000 to 1, she finished with a tired chuckle. "Wow. That bad, huh?" I asked, and both of the goddesses nodded in response. "So we're probably going to need to take steps to make sure that the centaurs aren't wiped out either," I mused quietly, one hand subconsciously reaching up and patting the top of Auravi's head, making the little goddess squirm in my lap. I was fine with the centaurs being knocked down a peg. It would be good for their personalities in the long run if they were on the losing end of a war. More importantly, this could serve to bring the variants and the normal centaurs closer together, fighting against a common enemy. Still, with the centaurs not yet unified, this could hardly be considered a fight at this point. I knew that I would have to step in and save them, but how to do so was still an issue. Looking up, I glanced at Terra curiously. "It's not possible to possess a mortal temporarily, is it?" I asked, and she shook her head. Figured, "We'd probably need to buy a new system for that. Either that or place a world host down in advance." Hearing that, Terra gave a small smile. "Worried about having enough influence to step in when the time is right?" When I nodded my head, she slowly stepped forward, practically collapsing onto the bed when she reached it. I could hear her talking into the mattress, but it wasn't until she turned her head that I was able to understand her. "That's a normal problem with keepers. That's why they act through others, giving orders to manipulate events, and when possible going down themselves to build a reputation for when they are needed." I was just about to retort when she lifted a hand, signaling me to wait. It took her a long moment to resume talking, and I half suspected that she had briefly dozed off. "Possessing a body is an easy solution if you buy the system, but it sucks." She waved her wrist slightly, and a window opened in front of me, showing the possession system listing on the Keeper forums, rather than the market entry. Of note was one ranter who complained about the system.
"Misbehave. Seriously, need to list the biggest flaw of this system. After possessing a mortal, the Keeper is not restricted to their level of power, and can at any moment bring out their Keeper abilities. However, doing so is a massive drain on the body. While there are no immediate symptoms, as soon as I left a body I had been possessing for a little over a week, she collapsed from multiple organ failure. I thought at first this was just a coincidence, but then the next one I possessed did so as well. I mean, really, why would you want to possess someone to make them influential, just to have them die after a few days? I wish I had known about that before wasting the 100 points. Would have gotten the easy reputation system instead." Aside from the name seeming a bit familiar, I was able to easily see why buying this system would lead to problems in the long run. When I looked up at her, Terra was already preparing to explain, though first she turned on her side and held open her arms. Auravi quickly jumped out of my lap to go lay down with Terra, willingly letting herself be used as a body pillow. "Keeper's powers are a huge drain on a body.
forcing it to go beyond its normal limits. It's one thing for a descended keeper, as their bodies are built to handle the sudden surge of power, but for a normal body, they can't stand the extra stress. And even if you don't use your keeper powers, the act of possessing them can lead to mental trauma.
Okay, I agreed with a nod of my head, understanding why this system was bad.
What about this easy reputation system? I couldn't help but notice how it was mentioned at the end of that post as a possible alternative for possession. Hearing my question, Tara's smile widened slightly. Again, she waved her hand, and another blue window appeared in front of me. This one looked like a market entry, rather than a forum post. Easy reputation. This convenience system allows a keeper to create a reputation for themselves prior to descending. By slightly altering the memories and documentation of the inhabitants, the keeper can insert themselves into almost any role, designed as an extra step when creating a body to descend in. Only unique roles, such as kings, presidents, or religious leaders, cannot be assumed unless they are currently vacant at the time of descending. Likewise, it is impossible to insert yourself as a parent of a mortal unless that mortal never knew the parent you were attempting to replace. 160 points. I felt my eyes widening in surprise as I read the description of this system. I mean, yes, it had its limits, but they were not really that heavy. As long as I didn't try to do anything obviously stupid, I could theoretically insert myself as whatever kind of figure I wanted. Of course, this raises questions of its own. Just how heavy are the effects of the memory alteration? Rather than answering me directly, Tara showed me the forum post for this system, where it was discussed in more detail. According to the various posts, summarizing it, it held certain similarities with the process of granting a personality to a god or goddess. The keeper in question designed the life that they wanted to be known to have lived, in as much or as little detail as they wished. They can include family, friends, love interests, whatever. Once they were done with that, the system would do its best to adjust the memories of the affected mortals to seamlessly place the keeper within that life, without changing the current structure of society by too large a degree. For instance, the system wouldn't recognize someone as having invented a spaceship in the Bronze Age, or creating world peace in their history, and would make them redo the reputation. Finally, there was one post that suggested that a keeper be prepared to fake their own death when they were done with the identity that they had created, so that their friends and family did not think they just went missing. This was what I was concerned about, and faking a death did sound like a very plausible method of going about it, especially if I were to use the world host and kill that. Okay, I'll have to remember that, I thought, saving that to bring up with Rian next time. Again, promised to let her manage finances, and can't be going back on my word this quickly. Anyways, I wanted to ask the two of you what the halflings were up to. That's why I called you both here in the first place. Right now, they just seem to be scouting out the territory, but the group they sent seems way too big for just a scouting mission. Unsurprisingly, it was Aurevi who spoke up, gently holding onto Terra's arms as they wrapped around her body. "That's really all it is, bro. Well, they're planning to make it more later, but that won't happen until the scouting group finishes mapping the Centaur-occupied territory and returns. After that, they plan to create actual fighting teams. They haven't specified how big each team would be because it depends on how many people they have willing to join them, and how many of the scouts survive the full trip. But the plan is for each fighting team to have at least one high-level scout that has fully explored the enemy territory." That is surprisingly advanced. Thank you, Tara, for beating me to that. However, the sudden blush in Aurevi's face made me think there was a bit more to it than that. "Well," she said guiltily after seeing my expression, "they call it the Probing Fingers Plan." Chapter 4. I blanked out for a moment when Aurevi said the name of the plan, then looked at her incredulously. "Who's been teaching our little sister naughty things?" I asked, causing her eyes to widen. Tara also looked down at her, her eyes suddenly seeming awake. "Yes," she said. "Who corrupted my little angel?" Unlike when I asked out of curiosity, Terra's words caused a chill to go down my spine, and I could practically feel the killing intent from her.
"We don't have angels,"
Aurevi suddenly spoke up, looking side to side as she tried to change the subject, before she let out a long breath.
"Guys, goddess of love here? You didn't think I'd stay innocent and naive forever, right?"
she asked, looking between myself and Terra. However, Terra simply shook her head, squeezing her arms around Aurevi to bring her more into her embrace.
"Not allowed. You are the little sister."
As she spoke now, her eyes seemed to haze over slightly, showing that she had gone back to focusing on her incarnations.
"Rivi, cute and innocent little sister."
Hearing that, Aurevi smiled gently, nodding her head.
"Okay, okay."
She reached her hand up to pat Terra's arm.
"I'll be the cute and innocent sister. I liked doing that anyways."
As she said that, she looked over to me, her smile widening.
"That okay with you, bro?"
I nodded my head, signaling that it was fine. Honestly, I don't think my heart would be able to take it if Aurevi showed off her more adult knowledge more often. Of course, I knew that she did have that knowledge now, but to see it was something entirely different. No matter how old she was, really, or how grown up, she was still a halfling, and that meant that she still looked like a preteen girl.
"Yay!"
she cheered for herself, stretching her arms out as much as she could within Terra's embrace.
"So what are you working on now, bro?"
she asked, as she looked over to me curiously.
"Well, right now I am trying to figure out how to go about this war so that the centaurs won't get totally wiped out.
No offense, but your people get pretty vicious when they are mad like this." I glanced towards the screen as I explained that to her.
"Yeah,"
I heard a somewhat melancholic voice from the bed behind me.
"I'd help, but we all agreed not to use our godly powers to get directly involved. Maybe Trival's incarnation will be able to do something about the war on his end."
I nodded my head slightly at that, though I didn't really have much hope. Among the gods, Trival was likely the least informed about the various classes and systems, as he had spent all of his time in the plains below instead of speaking with the others. At most, he would be able to become a decent monk or mage, depending on whether he incarnated as a variant. He wouldn't be able to pioneer new territory, like the others, so easily. Suddenly, Terra began speaking, her voice barely above a whisper.
"The problem isn't how to end the war. That will be pretty easy."
After letting out a low yawn, she continued,
"The problem is what comes after. The hatred. Hatred that can last for centuries. That's going to be the hard part."
I raised my brows at her words, but nodded nonetheless. Even in the history of my world, a single war could create lasting conflict. And this was after the world had advanced and modern morals had set in. I could only imagine the kind of hatred that would spring up from an archaic civilization having these kinds of conflicts. Still, I could only put that out of my mind for now. Even if I began making preparations for that right now, nothing would come of it for a while. It would ultimately be better to wait and see how things played out so that I can come up with a more effective response. In other words, so that I know who to ask for help.
"What? I'm new to this, okay?
Stopping a blood feud this deep is not an easy thing to accomplish. But at the same time, I can't just stand by and let it continue on until a second war breaks out. While I won't use my powers to tell them not to go to war, I can still do my best to prevent unnecessary wars from starting in the first place." Suddenly, Terra's ears perked up, her eyes widening.
"Dale, interesting thing just happened."
She spoke, her voice still groggy. I quickly turned back to look at the screen, but I could not see anything happening of importance, whether it was with the scouting team or the main forces of either side.
"No, not them."
"Details would be appreciated," I said with a sigh, figuring that it had something to do with her other incarnation then. Aside from knowing that she had chosen to incarnate as a beastkin, likely a feline, like herself, I didn't know exactly where she was, and doing a search to find out would take her far longer than her just telling me where she was and what happened.
"Ninja village, New discovery. She spoke with another drawn-out yawn. Why was I not surprised that she chose to be born in that village? With a sigh, I changed my view on the map to cover the ninja village instead. Well, I haven't checked them out in a while, so I guess it's a good way to take a break from the war. The village of the Hidden Fog, the name given to the ninja village since long ago, not because of any recurring weather patterns, but instead the fog that had rolled through near its creation, seeming to deposit people at random. Nobody could explain what had happened, so they had simply taken it to be divine providence. Ever since the founding of the village, those living in it had been training diligently in the ninja arts. And of course that means that they were stumbling around blindly, trying to adjust to this unfathomable power. Not only did they have to slowly discover the key aspects of chakra itself, but in order to truly understand it, they had to understand the features of its component energies, ki and mana. As such, this is what they spent their focus on, not on exploring or fighting or even developing their culture. They were led here by the gods, so why would they want to leave? The mastery of not one, but two energies gave them a complete advantage over the surrounding monsters. So what did they have to fear in a fight? As for their culture, it could be said that the ninja way was their culture. With this in mind, they advanced, farther and faster in the field of researching the energies than any other species. Although they did not strive to figure out the symbols that governed magic, they were ahead in terms of understanding exactly what magic was and what ki was. Inevitably, this led to some rather unusual leaps. It was a widely known fact among the village that it was impossible to store either ki or mana outside of the body. One came from within the body itself, while the other was a manifestation of thought. But at the same time, chakra was both similar and different. Unlike either of its parent energies, it was not created within the mind or the body, but outside of it. So many people began experimenting, trying to find ways to store chakra. This research carried on for over 100 years before any kind of breakthrough occurred, and what sprouted was a mere theory. If ki and mana can be stored in the body and mind, then could not chakra be stored in something with aspects from both? However, to get something that had the aspects of the body and mind was still a very difficult task. At least until they discovered enchanting. This branch of magic opened up a whole new world for them, one which they have been striving for all their lives. Solving the aspect of the body was easy, as it simply required blood from a creature capable of using ki. Some would use their own blood for this, while others would use the blood of monsters. However, the aspect of the mind was something that they had no clues for until now. This was their first real test of the theory, to determine whether chakra could be stored for later use. For the components, they used the blood of a monster and a length of vellum that had been enchanted. The village leader, Hanbi, stood in the center of a circle of beastkin. Standing before him was a statue of a golden kitsune, painted with various dyes that they had found throughout the forest. At the statue's feet was a stone bowl of blood, a single feather, and the vellum. Hanbi walked forward and grabbed the feather, dipping the sharpened tip of it in the monster blood, and began writing on the vellum. It was determined that the contents of what he wrote did not matter much, as long as the blood came to rest on the vellum. Some had even considered simply dipping the entire length in blood, but Hanbi had a different idea.
"Dale, may you watch over us now and guide my hand. Bring us the wisdom to complete this trial, as you brought wisdom to our ancestors."
Hanbi wrote these lines on the vellum and clasped his hands in prayer to the statue. Although most races had allowed the legend of the unknown god to fall into darkness, the ninjas were different. They found it no mere coincidence that a stranger appeared before them, teaching them the powers of the ninja. And then the gods sent them to live together and grow with this new power. To those in the village of the Hidden Fog, Dale was the hidden god, and many even believed he was the one responsible for the fog itself. After he was done writing the message,
he placed his hands on the corner of the vellum and began generating chakra to send into it. He was not seeking to activate any hidden ability or any secret power, merely storing his energy within. Those witnessing could see the vellum sheet beginning to glow blue, the words shining brightly. There were many who wanted to cheer, but held themselves back so as not to break Hanby's concentration. However, that glow soon faded, and with it the hopes of the audience. All but one, as Hanby opened his eyes wide to stare at the vellum. The others were too far to notice, but he could still clearly feel the power of chakra resting in the object before him. To be sure, he pulled his hands off of it, while keeping his senses focused. Although the sensation was dulled slightly when he wasn't directly touching the vellum, he could still feel the presence of his chakra. It was not breaking up or fading away, but instead resting peacefully inside its new container. For the final test, he placed one hand back on the vellum again, and attempting to connect with that energy to draw it back to himself. Once again there was a slight glow to it, before he felt his chakra returning. Although the process was slower than he would like, it proved that they were right. Chakra could be stored. It was at that time that one of the lichen men nearby came up and put his hand on Hanby's shoulder in a consoling manner.
"It's all right. You don't have to keep trying," he said in a somewhat disappointed tone.
To everyone else, the second glow simply looked like he had tried to put more chakra into the vellum.
"Huh?"
Hanby looked at him curiously.
"No, you misunderstood. It worked. Try it yourself."
As he said that, he stepped back to allow the lichen male to step up to the statue. And he did so, skeptically. While he was hopeful that their experiment had succeeded, he also did not want to doubt his own eyes. So as Hanby did, he generated chakra and sent it into the vellum. And like Hanby, he could feel its presence remaining in the parchment. His eyes widened as he stared at it, reaching down and picking it up as if it were a precious artifact.
This is it!
He let out a sharp cry.
By Dale! This is what we have been working for!
So? Terra asked, and I could detect a grin in her tired voice. What do you think?
Why?
I asked, my head buried in a pillow. I wanted to just hide from the world right now. Of course, I had already been hidden from the world for a long time, but that's not my point. Why was there an entire village that worshipped me? I could easily recognize that statue that they were gathered around, and the words that they had written. Advancement, energy storage, it's important, right? She asked, slyly. Now, they can make things like talismans, very important for their development. I had long since left the computer, hiding in the bed under the covers as if worried that the people in the screen would be able to look up and see me watching them. However, that allowed a certain excitable goddess to wander over to it.
"Oh, what's going on?"
she asked curiously, looking at the screen. Although the goddesses could not use any of the keeper functions on the computer, they could still easily read the display.
"Wow, bro, you have a cult!"
And thus the halfling delivered the final blow.
"Can I go back to watching midgets and horsemen killing each other now? That sounds really fun compared to this."
Chapter 5. Distracting myself from the fact that I did indeed have a cult of ninjas worshipping me, I once again returned my attention to the war, curious to see how things were progressing. And again I had to speed up drastically, watching them scurry around the plains like a long montage. Even after another 5 years passed, they had not returned to the forest. However, by the end of that 5 years, they had apparently scouted as much as they had hoped to. Perhaps if they had split up and all gone off on their own, that period of time would have been enough to scout out the entirety of the plains. But they had to stop before even getting halfway done. As for the reason why...
"They got homesick," Aurevi spoke up,
once again acting as Terra's hug pillow. Though she sported a wry smile on her face, I couldn't help but notice a faint giggle, as she seemed to think about it.
Even if they are a traveling people, they've gone 5 years without any contact, trapped in hostile territory. I guess the stress was just too much for them. I could only nod my head slightly at that. I really did not know how much the halflings had planned to scope out. Simply telling them to investigate the entire area that the centaurs occupied without knowing how large of an area that was would be an assignment that could easily last for generations. Looking at Aurevi, I expressed that concern, earning me another laugh from the young goddess. They were simply told to map as much as they could before returning. They weren't really given a time limit, though. Anyways, if they took too much longer, then it is possible that their mission would be entirely forgotten by the people that sent them there in the first place, she explained, shrugging her shoulders. I nodded my head slightly at that, before turning to Terra. By the way, there was something that I wanted to ask you before. I saw the cat girl's ears twitch, though she kept her eyes closed. With your incarnations, what are you able to do? I imagine that there must be rules or something, right? Surely you wouldn't be unable to tell me information, but could still act on it with your incarnation. There was a small whining purr from Terra as she heard that, before one of her eyes opened up.
Yeah, that's why I can only handle two at once, she admitted. I have to devote extra effort to sealing a portion of my mind that handles the advanced information in the incarnations. I can't even do as much with that system as the others can.
Seeing me look at her curiously, she cuddled up to Aurevi a bit closer, nuzzling her head into the top of the halfling goddess's.
I can't act on any information unknown to the world and its inhabitants, unless you give me specific directions to do so. Of course, that means you would also have to know that information to give me those directions. That's why my incarnation is able to play a part in the war, because you are directing it through me. Saying that much, her lips pouted cutely. The others can all use their own knowledge to advance various fields, but me, who knows all of the necessary information, can only do so much.
I couldn't help myself but chuckle at that thought. And let me guess, the first thing you taught the ninja village was about elemental ki and ki paths? Terra's eyes opened wide for a brief moment, before slowly closing again.
Nuh-uh. They, actually, started to figure out elemental ki before I was old enough to reasonably help, but abandoned the research for it because it interfered with their ability to create chakra. As for ki paths, I considered it. Maybe after they advance a bit further in their chakra research, so I don't distract them. I like the direction they are going in.
She spoke with a content smile, her eyes fully closing. Now, that was a small tidbit of information I found interesting, and very relevant for me.
You can't make chakra with elemental ki? I asked, doubtfully. It should be possible, right?
Terra smiled a bit more, her eyes still closed.
Not the same kind of chakra, at least. Once you add elemental energy to ki, the balance becomes wrong. It's like trying to make the same dish with a big extra ingredient. For you personally, it won't be much of an issue. You can rely on your keeper abilities to either give yourself a body with normal ki, or take normal ki from your keeper reserves when needed. But for a normal person, once they become an elemental monk, they can't easily become a ninja.
I nodded my head slightly as I considered that. It did make sense. Is it possible to have both normal ki and elemental ki without having to manually replenish it? For a normal person, I mean? When I asked that, Terra's face became unusual. She knit her brows together as if she was deep in thought and frowned slightly. She opened her mouth to speak, but then abruptly closed it before speaking in a somewhat bitter tone.
I can't tell you how.
I'm able to tell you that it is possible, but even saying that I can't tell you confirms that.
But your world hasn't gotten close enough to that answer for me to help you with it. She explained reluctantly, an apologetic smile on her face.
I let out a relieved sigh, hearing that it was possible. Eventually I would want to be able to use my ninja class without relying on my keeper reserves. After all, accessing those reserves causes a rather unpleasant situation where everyone immediately feels my power. I'd rather not have that happen when it is possible to avoid. Thanks.
I turned my head back to the computer screen and saw that the halflings were still slowly making their way back towards the forest. Although they had spent over 5 years exploring, they had been exploring in various directions, and were now able to travel in a straight line back to the forest. By my estimate, it would only take them another 6 months to reach the rest of the halflings again, as long as they were careful not to